Access number 29537, Mr. Albert Arndt, Rail 5. Now, how did the course finish, you know, this course in wireless and escape at Gotenhagen?
Well, we went through all the routines required. We gradually got used to our escape suits. We got used to being down, you know, in the water to simulate an escape in case something should happen.
Was there a final test on all this, on the wireless training thing?
No, there were no final tests. I think it was sort of, the results were accumulated throughout the course and sort of ticked off, you had done this and you had done that. So we passed out, as it were. And then came the time when we sort of passed out, as it were.
And that's right about June. Yeah, it is, June 43.
Sometime like that, yes.
And you then seem to go to a transit camp. Do you remember anything about that? It's at Neustadt,
yes,
Neustadt.
Neustadt,
yeah.
Yes. We stayed there in kind of barracks huts for a while. I can't remember how long it was. And then we were sort of sorted out and people were transferred to different places. I and some of my mates were transferred to the Vulcan shipyard in Bremen, yes, where our boat actually was being built. It was sort of coming near to completion, and we again stayed in kind of barracks, and the crew was sort of gradually assembled. All different members, officers, you know, wireless operators, torpedo mechanics, electricians, seamen, and whatever, were gradually assembled, and the crew was put together. We met our captain, and then the first and the second officer. Our job was really to go every day down to the shipyard and actually watch and go through the boat, which, and all things were explained to us, you know, where what was and what we had to do and where you were and where they were.
Now just tell them what number the ship was, because it was you.
The submarine was U-293. It was a type 7C boat.
Now, what were your first impressions of? What can you describe a Type 7C boat? Can you describe the just in as much detail as you can from your memories of what your first impressions were of this U-boat?
Well, our first impression was actually, there it is. This is going to be your ship. This is going to be your home for however long. And first time we actually went down the conning tower, you know, into the control room. You're sort of amazed what you see, all these, well, it seemed to be hundreds of little wheels and levers and lights and buttons and gauges, whatever. We were first generally taken over the boat from stern to the bow. You know, we had in the bow was four torpedo tubes, and that was the quarter of the crew itself. And then came the quarters for the of the NCOs, as it were. Then came the officers' quarters, and opposite the officers' quarters were the wireless rooms. And then you went through one of these big, what do you call them?
Bulkheads.
Bulkheads, yes. Into the center of the boat, which was the control room. And there was the ladder going up through the conning tower onto the top of the bridge. And after the after the control room, there was another quarters for sort of the midshipmen's men, and then came the kitchen, which was almost impossible to imagine how anybody can cook, and you know, for 48 people in that little place. And there was also one toilet in the kitchen on the starboard side. And after the kitchen came the diesel room, two big diesels in there, and after that was the electric motor room, and there was one torpedo tube at the stern, so we had five altogether.
Now, yeah, you were being taken round the ship and the boat, I don't know what you call it, U-boat anyway, and your new crew members were arriving. What else were you doing? You seem to have gone swimming a lot in the Weser. It's Bremen, isn't it? It's Bremen Vegesack. Is that part of Bremen?
Vegesack, yeah. It's Bremen. Outside from Bremen, yes. Right. Yes, on the river Weser.
Mm. And did you go swimming in the Weser?
Oh, we did. Yes, we did. Yes. It was great fun. I don't know how clean the river actually was, but it was nice. Of course, to keep us fit, we had sort of a bit of sport, we played football, we did a bit of gymnastics and a bit of running and also swimming.
And would you go out in Bremen in the evening or?
Well, the evening were ours. We could go out, you know, into the town. So what you do, of course, at that time there were the air raids were starting. And it was practically every night. It was an air raid.
Now, what were these air raids like?
Well, you could hear, obviously, you could hear the airplanes. You heard some bombs, explosions. You hear a lot of anti-aircraft fire, which was quite loud. And whenever that happened, we had to sort of go into shelter, as it were, stand somewhere under protection, whether it was a house or something. Because of the all the little bits from the anti-aircraft, they came down, and I remember very clearly the trees were in leaf then. But when it came down, it was you know, all these bits of ammunition went through the trees and sometimes knocked the leaves off.
Did you see much of the damage that they were doing to Bremen?
No, we didn't.
What was the morale of the civilian population like under all this bombing?
Well, they seem to be okay. I mean, you accepted there was a war on and you got used to the routine, you know, when the sirens went off, when the air raids went off. I think most of them went into allocated bunkers or cellars or whatever. Yeah. There was no... Well, it was taken for granted. That is what it was. And people accepted it.
Right. Now, were you actually doing any duties on board the boat, or just getting it? Was it just familiarisation, really?
It was familiarisation as a whole. And then, of course, all departments had their own training. For instance, we as wireless operators, we were familiarised with our equipment. You know, we had the short wave, we had the long wave, transmitter and receiver, and you had all the other bits to go with it. That was in one little room, and the other room was where the listening devices were, and you were sort of instructed and trained on how to work them, what to do, what to listen out. Of course, then being still at the shipyard, we had to listen to records with all different noises, so you could distinguish between a steam engine, the propeller noises, or a turbine, a merchant ship, a warship, and all the other noises you hear, you will hear in the sea, even the squeaking of whales and noises of fish. So the reason was to get an idea what was important and what wasn't important. And that took sort of every day until the boat was finished and was actually commissioned, which was, I think, in September.
It said July, you do your first sailings.
Yeah.
Now, another thing I just want to ask you, it was a very busy, I mean, this was a builder's yard.
Well, yes, oh yeah, shipyard, yes.
Was it very evident, were there lots of ships being built? What was it like in the harbour?
Well, there were, of course, more than one submarine being built. I mean, I can't remember how many there were next to each other. They were all in different stages of progress, as it were. So the time came when our boat was finished, was inspected by the, you know, the people from the shipyard. And the day came when it was actually being commissioned. Then it was handed over from the shipyard.
Was there a commissioning ceremony? Do you remember that?
There was a commissioning service, yes.
What was it like? What happened?
Well, obviously some higher personalities from the German Navy came. I can't remember who they were. Probably an admiral and some other officers. And the boat was then officially commissioned, handed over.
Was this the same day as it was launched? Or
No, that was later. It was launched. It's in there.
Is it later or earlier?
First it was launched.
And then, what was the launching like?
Well, we all stood there, and when the trumpet blew, you know, the shipyard worker did their thing, and the boat slid into the water. And then there are certain things which can only be finished off when actually the boat is in the water. I can't remember the dates. We were commissioned, I think, in September.
In September, fair enough.
1943, yes.
So what happened after you were commissioned then?
Well, we actually, from that time on, we actually lived on the boat. You know, not in barracks anymore.
Now, what was your accommodation like on the boat?
Well, we were in the bow compartment, the front torpedo compartment.
Now, that were you the in crews, with the were crew. You in the with the rest of the crew?
Yes, yes.
Now, what were the crew quarters like? I mean,
very cramped.
Can you just describe what it was like? Because people can't picture it really.
No. Well, when you came into the front torpedo room, there was on either side were bunks, metal bunks, which could be sort of tilted over against the wall, as it were, because room had to be made later on for the torpedoes, you know, to be stored there and torpedoes be loaded into the tubes, into the forward tubes. So these bunks, as it were, they were sort of swung over and clipped against the wall. There were removable tables, which could be folded up and put aside, where we had our meals. Of course, the boat was then still brand new. Everything was sparkling. Paint, you could steal the new paint. It takes a while to get used to the cramped situation. There wasn't much room. And it's, I mean, if you compare a submarine then to a submarine now, it's like a five-star hotel.
Now, your first, so you seem to go to Hela, which is in the Bay of Danzig, or Gdansk.
Yeah. Well, we went down the River Weser to a place called Brunsbüttel, which was the entrance of the Kiel Canal, which connects the North Sea with the Baltic. And on one Sunday, we went through the canal to Kiel, which is...
Oh, you went to Kiel first?
To Kiel first, before yes. Hela. Oh, yes.
What did you do at Gsu? What was that first voyage like?
Very exciting. Of course, the boat was still light because we didn't have torpedoes, we didn't have ammunition, we didn't have really fully provisioned. It was just, everything was so new and everything was still being tested out. I suppose the officers had to get used to giving orders to the machinery, and gradually we sort of learned to coincide with each other, to understand what they do. They understood what we do. And we went through the Kiel Canal. We stayed in Kiel for a little while.
What were you doing there?
There were some trials made, which meant that perhaps, I would say, half a dozen of the shipyard personalities were still on board with us to check things over, made sure that all the gauges, all the valves and whatever worked correctly, that the diesel were running properly.
So you would actually go under the sea?
Oh yes. Yes, that was in the Bight of Kiel. And then there was one day was the diving, what we call deep diving. You had to go to a certain depth to make sure around the leakages and everything worked, and that seemed to have been quite satisfactory. And when that was completed, we went from Kiel right through the Baltic up to the Hela Peninsula, which is slightly north of Danzig. I can't remember what it is called now because it is Polish.
I know what you mean though.
Yeah.
And what sort of thing, was this where you did your working up trials?
That was the working up trials, yes.
Now what were these like?
Well, I would say one of the main trials and exercises was to get the boat underwater as quickly as possible.
So what was crash dive procedure? Can you go through
crash
it?
Dive
that's
procedure.
What you're talking about, isn't it?
That is what I'm talking about. All this was first exercised in the harbour, which means the conning tower was open, the bow torpedo hatch was open, so you had to climb up the conning tower and exercise sliding down that iron ladder, is it like, into the control room. When you came down into the control room, there was a big mat. It reminds me when they used to unload the beer barrels, you know, they dump it onto the mat. So when you slid down, you didn't hit anything hard. And there were usually two men standing down there. As soon as you reached the bottom, they took you and put you in the direction you had to go, because everything was so quick. And that was done for hours and hours on end every day. Because
you
had to get...
You didn't go down the steps, did you?
You had to just hold on the sides and slid down, and the inside of your feet guided you sort of down. Because if you had your fingers on the rungs, on the steel rungs, there was the possibility that somebody else stood on your fingers and you lose all your fingertips. It was very, very hard work.
Now, was there anything else about crash diving? I mean, someone would have to close the hatch,
yeah.
I presume.
I mean, when that procedure was sort of to the satisfactory of the officers, then, of course, when we went out and did all the other trials, diving, torpedo, shooting and that, and then it was actually exercised in reality. That means usually the captain or at least one officer of the watch was on the bridge, plus four outlooks. And when the klaxon went and it went alarm, then you had to just forget everything and went down as quickly as you could. And the last one, which was the officer or the captain, whoever was on duty, closed the hatch. And as soon as the alarm went, the diesel mechanics shut off the diesel engines. They put the exhaust, closed the exhaust valve, switched on the electric motors, and in the control room there were two sailors sitting on the, now what do you call these things on the side, these in English, you know, when you have a rudder and the stern to give you the direction which you go in, but you have on the bow and in the stern, you got these flaps which help you to go down as quickly as possible.
I know what you mean. I can't think of the word.
I think...
Well, don't worry about it.
You probably know what
they'll
mean.
They'll know what you mean.
And, of course, to help the boat to go down quickly, all the crew, everyone free of duty from the boat, from the rear department of the boat, had to run quickly down into the front torpedo compartment to make it heavy so the boat went down quicker. And it was the duty of the leading engineer, the engineer officer, who directed these two men sitting on these flat who operated the
flaps,
whatever they were called, because once you were underwater you had to catch up the boat because it was heavy in the front, in the bow. So you had to adjust these flaps in a certain way, with the speed of the boat that you gradually level out. And the engineer gave all the orders to the men. They gave orders to those who controlled the valves of the trim. For instance, he said, well, trim 50 liters from bow to stern or something like this to balance the boat out. And that had to be practiced for quite a few times, because the time from the alarm to the boat being under the surface of the sea, it was 30 seconds. 30 seconds. We did it actually more or less in the end in 27. So you can understand, the quicker you go down, the better it was and safer it was.
So you were practicing these off Hala?
That was all in the, yes, off the Hala Peninsula in the Baltic.
And anything happened? Did you get seasick down there? That's something I wondered, because there's reference here to seasickness, or is it just the fumes? I mean, because it must be unusual down there. I'm not sure whether you get seasick or not in the summer.
Well, on the surface, of course, people get seasick at first. I mean, I was seasick, and you get all these very peculiar advice what you should do. I mean, thinking of it afterwards, it was, of course, complete nonsense. For instance, one said, well, if you're seasick, you stand over there, you look into that red light for about 10 minutes, and your seasickness will go. I think it was a lot of psychology in it as well. I remember one of the old-timers, the older sailors, said, well, the best is when you're seasickness, you take a bit of bacon, you know, a little lump of bacon, you put it on a piece of cotton, you swallow it, when you swallow it, you pull it back up, down, up, and then you swallow it again. You do that 4 or 5 times and your seasickness will go. I mean, it took a while. I had no problems. I think 2-3 days I got used to it. I had no more problems. Some never, ever were ever free from seasickness. In a mild way. Yeah, you got used to it, and you know, you grew your sea legs, as it were. Obviously, when you were underwater, it was quieter. There wasn't much movement.
Now, I see why there's confusion. It's because when you were at Hala, you weren't on board. You were on board other submarines, from the looks of it.
No, that was.
Or was that on the 293?
That was on the 293.
Okay,
yes,
yeah.
That was our boat. Yeah.
Okay, there's a slight confusion of time in your account there, but it doesn't matter. I mean, this is how it's remembered to you now. So now it's on the way back from Hala.
I think we spent actually Christmas, 1943, in Hala. If I remember right, because it was very, very cold up there, very rough and very unfriendly.
Okay. Now, so then, what happened next then that you remember? So, there seems to be some confusion on time, definitely. So, can you talk to me a bit about your captain that was on board the ship?
Yes.
And your the officers. You must have had a wireless officer, I presume. But I don't know who you want to start with.
Well, start with the captain. The
what
captain
was his name?
he was then a lieutenant. His name was Klinkspor. Yes. Lieutenant Klinkspor.
Do you know how you spell it?
Klingspor. Klinkspor. He was at the time 20 years old. He had, of course, been on operational submarine as first officer. I cannot remember what submarine was on, you know, during the 41 years. And then he went on his training course to become a captain of a submarine, and then he came to us. He was okay, he was a fair man. I learned later on, of course, that he was very interested in history, and he was actually training, he went probably university or something before war, to become an historian as well. First officer, well, the first officer was sort of in charge of the boat itself, the provisioning, the ammunition and all that.
So would he be a lieutenant as well?
He was a lieutenant as well, but a sub-lieutenant. You know, our captain had two golden stripes. He was an Oberleutnant, which is slightly higher than an ordinary sub-lieutenant. And the third officer,
what was he like? Do you remember his name?
Yeah, his name was Weiser, W-I-S-E.
Lieutenant Weiser.
Yes, he was fairly youngish. I would say he was perhaps 22, 23.
Good officer?
He was a good officer, yes, because he had a big load of responsibility. So he was mostly, of course, he had to concentrate on his duties. But he was fair. He was a good disciplinarian. You know, he said, you do what I tell you to do and everything is okay. The third officer, he wasn't an actual officer yet. He was he was called a Fähnrich. Now, what is that? An ensign or something? He had one little thin stripe around his sleeve.
And what was his name?
His name was Grande. Grande.
What was Grande like?
He was a very, very easygoing person. He was a kind person. He had understanding. And he was in charge of definitely all to do with the radio, anything to do with the wireless room. And he was also in charge when messages were relieved. You know, we had that Enigma decoding machine. He used to work that to decode the messages and then hand over to the captain or to the officer in charge. Yeah, he was nice. He was well liked. But he had something which you respected, I would say, and you never took advantage because he was a kind man.
Now, can we have a look at your two wireless rooms? You had two wireless rooms, didn't you? So tell me what the rooms were for, and could you describe the equipment in them?
The first wireless room, the transmitter one. Yes. That was exactly opposite the captain's sleeping quarters. Now, the captain's sleeping quarters were only separated by a very thick, long, green, heavy curtain, which he could draw across, so he had some privacy. But in that wireless room, were the shortwave transmitter and receiver, also the longwave transmitter and receiver, and we had a receiver which was extra long wave, with which we could actually receive signals when we were underwater at a certain depth. It went up to a certain depth, but that was the only way we could receive signals.
How many signals would be in there? Just one?
Sorry?
There's just one signal in there at a time?
One. Yeah, one.
Anything else about that room? Anything else in there?
Well, there was a wooden stool, if you like, almost like a piano stool, which were where the papers were, you know, certain documents and papers were in there, especially the coding and decoding papers were in there, which were all printed in red print on pink paper. The reason was, as soon as they get moist, everything dissolves. They were kept in that stool where the wireless operator on duty was sitting on. Well, you had your set of earphones. You had in front of you a little table, oh, about 2 foot deep, maybe 3 foot wide, is when you could do your writing. The next room adjacent.